Something's very late.
Yeah, we had to jump out of dummy fuselage, which is quite painful sometimes if we didn't land properly. And then we went straight up in the air. We jumped out of Dakota's static line. The ground around Chaklala, which was up in rather high, rather pindy, sort of more or less in the northwest frontier, we had a lot of trouble with these turbulent winds at around about 200 feet. And I don't think any of us ever landed properly. We always hit rocks or landed heavily on the ground. We were using 12-foot to 14-foot canopies and enormous things. They were supposed to be dirigibles, but not really. I know that one or two people tried to collapse part of their parachute so that you could control them, but there were some fatalities at Chaklala when they did that, because the parachute folded up completely and they were candled down, as they called it. But that was the training we had there. And towards the end of 44, I had already been selected for appointment to the Burma Police. My godfather, who was then head of the Civil Affairs Service that had been formed, he was a man called C.F.B. Pierce, a very senior Indian civil servant. He was then given a military rank. He was then made a major general in charge of the Civil Affairs Service. He was very keen that I should be taken out of ISLD and join the Civil Affairs Service, but ISLD wouldn't release me till the end of 44. I think it was about January or February 1945 that I was transferred to the Civil Affairs Service, and I think it was about end of February we went into Burma, and I was accredited to the Tharavadi district of Burma as an assistant superintendent of police under training.
Where is this district?
It's central Burma, about 120 miles north of Rangoon, on the road to Prome, which is on the Irrawaddy, a prominent town there. Tharavadi was halfway along. And that's how I started my police career then.
How did you take to it?
Very much. Enjoyed it.
And what were the main problems for the police in Tharavadi area?
Oh, well, it was, I think, do we want to go on to that now?
If possible?
Hmm.
Why not?
Because we'll go to the assassination and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
I got the promise from the Inspector General of Police, a man called R.G.B. Prescott, that the very minute that I'd finished that 1 year's probationary service, I would be given a subdivision. Now, police subdivision in Burma consists mainly of about six police stations. You have about 500 men under you, and you're virtually your own boss. You're well away from headquarters. You run your own crime teams. You have your own men. You have your armed police. And you're a little chief of police there. And I must say, Robbie Prescott kept his word. And it was the 11th hour of the particular date when I'd finished that 1 year's training, during which time I had to pass police procedure, criminal law and practice. I had to pass the colloquial language examination. When I phoned him and I said, you know the R, and he said, yes, where do you want to go? And I chose Zigolam subdivision, which was slightly north, part of the Tharavadi district. And I went there as subdivisional police officer. And I had a wonderful time there. I didn't do very much police work. I was chasing bandits all the time. Because at that stage, the Burma Defense Army, those that were not taken into the reformed Burma Rifles still had their arms, and of course they were living off the land, shooting up buses, intimidating villagers to keep and feed them. In fact, they took over whole areas and they had them under their control. In the meantime, they were mixed up with the communists as well, the Red Flag communists, who were the only ones that rose up in rebellion against the Japs in 1945, because the AFPFL, the Anti-Fascist People's Freedom League, and the BDF were not very inclined to sort of have a go at the Japanese, because Aung San was still sort of a general of the Burma Defense Army. I know that he had planned to rise up against the Japanese, but the ones that really went for the Japs were these communists. And they expected that at the end of hostilities, they would be called in along to participate in the government of Burma, because they were responsible to a certain extent of pushing the Japs out, but this didn't happen. We took to the AFPFL and Aung San, and there were people like Thakin So, Thakin Thanthun, who were communist leaders, who had sort of more or less gone into the bush. And they were conducting operations against the government. And of course, the government went thus. The British were still in control of Burma. So I spent all my time as an ex-Gurkha officer who knew how to deal with insurgents, going out into the bush, chasing these fellows, shooting them down. And I must say that within 6 months, I brought that whole district, the whole area that I was in charge of, under control. They knew that we meant business. I formed gangs of police. I made these police join gangs of these people and then slowly eliminate them. And of course, I caused confusion there because they didn't know who was killing who. And in that way, we put pay to these people, and of course, they all went up into the hills. Once they went up into the hills, of course, they were harassing poor Karens and people like that in the Bigu Yomas, who had helped us during the war. So my operations went even further, and I went up to the hills. Well, I love the hills and I love the jungles, and although I was sort of being fired at, fired killing these people, to me it was a nice expedition. You see. It was a nice life, really. I enjoyed that life and I took to it. And I must say I had a very fine force of 500 men. They were so loyal to me. Eventually I was called upon to...
But excuse me interrupting you, but what was the connection between the ex-Burma Defense Army men and the Red Flag Communists?
Well, they'd all joined up and become gangs. You see, the Burma BDA were... I don't think they had any sort of strong political views. If they could have joined... They joined up armed gangs where at least... I don't think it was a case of... The communists were keen on taking over territory and administering. That was their idea. But the BDA chaps, if they didn't do go and prey on villages and what have you for food and shelter, they would have starved because they had nowhere to go. So they formed these gangs, and it was my job. Tharamwadi district had always had the reputation of being a very, very bad district, because it was there that the Burma Rebellion in 1930 started.
Why was it that Tharawadi was the place where the Burma Rebellion had started in 1930? What was the reason for that?
Well, it was the district where a chap called Sia Sun, Sia meaning teacher, his name was Sun, and he was supposed to be a Burmese hermit or something. About that particular time, I don't know all the reasons for it, but there was the agrarian problem where Indian moneylenders and all were taking over land on loans, and there was a lot of land in Tharawadi that had been mortgaged to these money lenders. The British government, these people felt, wasn't doing enough to see that these people got their land back. They didn't understand that if you borrowed money, you had to give security, and the land was security. And therefore, there was no way, unless they went to court, that some sort of thing could be done for them, you see. So that unrest. Plus, this fellow Siar San seemed to indicate that he was a descendant of the royal family, and they were going to bring Burma back to the old kingdom and what have you. So this started with a series of riots and what have you. It was very well planned. They had a lot of people in the Tharawadi district and the Prome district. And of course they got themselves armed with muzzle loading, shot their guns. He got a lot of people tattooed, making them believe that by being tattooed by him, or people acting for him, they were bulletproof. So this started off the Burma Rebellion, which lasted till 1932. And it all started from there. And it was finally suppressed. It moved off into the Prome district. There were some very big battles there. Several British officers were killed by the rebels. I happened to be there at the time as a youngster because my father was posted to Prome. And he was in charge of public works and what have you. And there were many occasions where we used to be taken out for drives in the evening and we got stopped. Unfortunately, the people that stopped us who had joined me, the rebels, were my father's men working on the roads. And they always said, you know, passed us on.
So you were in Tharawadi for about a year.
A year.
45, 46?
46, when it was suggested I get transferred, because being an ex-Gurkha officer, Operation Flush had started in the Tongu and the Pyamuna area. Now, Tongu and Pyamuna were on the Pigu road towards Mandalay. Tharawadi was in another branch on the Prome road, anyway. This man, Tun Laang, who subsequently became the Deputy Inspector General of CID and who I was involved with in the assassination, he had been posted up there as DIG operations in this rebellion area. In fact, it was the uprising of the White and the Red Bank communists in very, very large numbers. They were all well armed. They managed to get Sten, Brens, they had mortars. Their men were fairly well trained. Trained against the army. These were all the remnants too of the chaps that fought against the Japanese. So I was then posted there on rebellion duty, accredited to Tongu Subdivision as a subdivisional police officer, but posted to the Tongu Pyamuna rebellion area in charge of police operations to assist the army. Now, there was a sub-area there which was equivalent to a brigade under a Brigadier Gerard. And in that brigade, you had the 1st 10th Gurkha Rifles, the 6th Rajpurana Rifles, and the 13th Fatehpur Regiment. Well, being an ex-Gurkha officer, I was accredited to the 1st 10th Gurkha. That went on. We had many a skirmish with the communists there. I don't believe that we we had the 4th Burma Rifles, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Nay Win. He was a Pyamuna. I saw quite a lot of him. He was very anti-British at the time. It was very difficult for him to get him to come to these brigade conferences, and the Brigadier General said, asked me to bring him along, and I used to say, come along, and he said, oh, I don't give a damn to the British. I run my own show, and that was his attitude. May 1947, I got a call from Kidlow, who by that time moved down to Rangoon as DIG CID. Called me on my private telephone and he said, I want you to come down to Rangoon as quickly as possible. I have something in mind that you can help me with. So I said, well, do I get transferred or something? He said, no, not at this juncture. But it's something very important that's going along and I want you as part of the team. So I said, when do you want me done? He said, well, tomorrow. And I said, well, look, Terry, I can't. I don't want to come down tomorrow because in two days' time. I know it was the 20th of May. 2 days' time is my wedding anniversary. And I want to be here with my wife to celebrate it. And he said, all right, as soon as possible after that. Well, I'm pretty sure that I left Tongu. He said, I don't want you to tell your superior police officer, your district superintendent, that you're coming down to Rangoon. The only person who knows that you are coming down to see me is the district commissioner, Mr. Kenneth Foster. He will explain to your chief your absence. And he said, when you come down, come straight to my house in private residence in Windermere Park. Bring down two or three men that you rely on, who are very reliable. So I said, okay. So I left it on the afternoon of the 25th, got down to Rangoon. He wasn't there, but his wife said, yes, we've got a room ready for you. Your men can go and stay out. They had servants' quarters there. And Tillard turned up at my 10 o'clock that night. He'd been in conferences. He said, now, the next thing I want you to do is you were very well known in the Thurrawaddy district, particularly in the Zeeglon subdivision. I know that your men were very fond of you, and you were very reliable men. He said, I want you to go and get at least 10 to 12 men that you trust implicitly from that area. I will make arrangements to inform the chief of police of Thurrawaddy after you've collected these men, but I don't want anybody to know who they are and when you've collected them. Now, when you've got them, bring them down to Rangoon and put them up in the quarters here temporarily, and I can make arrangements then to move them to a proper place where they can be accommodated. So, 4 days later, it was then getting on to about 1st of June. In the meantime, Tumal told me that some Brens and Stens had gone missing from the police depot. I don't know whether it was, it must have been early June. He just said, you know, guns were missing or what have you. He told me that he wanted me to take over an operation watching Usaw's house. The oldest connection was because Usaw was a Thurrawaddy man. Of course, I'd been in Thurrawaddy district. And he asked me if I knew Usaw. I said, yes, of course I knew. He said, well, I want you to take an operation over where we are watching his bungalow, but I'll tell you more about it when you've collected your men. So I was away for about 4 days. I must have come back to Rangoon about the 4th or 5th of June. I'd taken a truck and a station wagon down and I'd collected these men and brought them in. They were armed. They stayed in Kilmarnock's servants' quarters for a couple of days, and then they were moved on to the military police barracks in Rangoon on the Pone Road. Then he said, I've already got spotters on the lake watching Usaw's house, and I know that the very first time he showed me the bungalow was quite late at night, must have been around the first week of June, after I'd come back from Thurrawaddy, and just to give you the layout. It was off the Mingledon Road in Kokain, where you had the lake on both sides of the road, and then you could see the bungalow, which jutted out on a sort of like an isthmus. It had its own landing stage. And then AD Road, it was off the Mingledon Road, and you went and you pass the entrance to the bungalow. It was the first one on the right-hand side, where it had a big set of wrought iron gates, and there were some huts and what have you near the gates. And he said, he's got armed sentries there, we believe. Did I know anybody along AD Road? And I said, yes. The road was named after Mr. AD, who was a well-known businessman in London, and his son, Aylmer, A-L-M-E-R, otherwise known as Tiger, and his wife Doris, lived in the house at the bottom end, top end of AD Road. I said, he said, do you think you can rely on him to help in any sort of way? I said, well, I can ask him. He said, I've got somebody else to, a chap called Malcolm Khan. His father was a police officer, and Malcolm lived in another bungalow, another house, near Tiger Lady's house. I also knew another family called Otwells. There was Marjorie and Peggy. They were European girls. Their father, I think, was a judicial officer. But they were there. And he said, well, you know enough people here, and that's the reason why I brought you down. So that you could have a, say, communications headquarters, and I chose AD. I put Tiger in the picture, and he said to me as well that he'd seen a lot of army trucks going in and out of Newsall's house and just wondered what was going on there. Anyway, having done all that and shown me the place, I took charge of this small group that was watching the house. Tunang had brought an Anakin sub-inspector, a man called Tunang Jor from Akian, who he said was a relation of his, and he could trust implicitly. And Tunang Jor had brought some Anakin policemen with him, and they were using them to act as fishermen on the lake. And I said, well, don't they stand out? And he said, no, people fish on that lake, and they would lose all over the shop, and it wouldn't cause any... you sort of wonder what these people are doing there. He said, in any case, they're sufficiently far away for not to raise any sort of suspicion. Well, I went out myself on the lake in another canoe, dressed up like a Burmese fisherman with a big bamboo hat on, and I could see the bungalow from there. I had a pair of binoculars. And so it went on. In that time, Tuong Jo, who was in charge of a group of four, was logging everything that went on. And I was having a look at his log and discussing things with him. And he mentioned a lot of army officers. And he said that there was one gentleman, Englishman, who used to come in civilian clothes. I said, what do you mean civilian clothes? He said, well, a white shirt and shorts, sometimes a light suit. And he described this fellow, and I said, well, I don't know. He described other people he'd seen, and he said they were all wearing army insignia. Three or four regular visitors, army people. And so I went out and had a look, because I said, well, when does he come, this man in civilian clothes? He said, well, he often comes in the afternoon, between 4 and 5. And he said, he's fairly regular. So I went out one afternoon on the off chance, and sure enough, I saw this man alive. And I made note of him, because I had a pair of binoculars, and I didn't recognize him at all. I used to keep Tunang informed of all the people that came in. This fellow Tuong Jo also said that army trucks had arrived in the house, and that a lot of barrels, 56 gallon oil drums, had been on one occasion offloaded from these trucks. And then he'd seen all these barrels immersed in the water in front of the bungalow, and ropes that were secured to them were tied against the trees and left on the tied to the mud. He said there were about, he thought about 4 or 6. So all these things were reported to Tunang, and then he said, I wonder who this chap is that you saw as well, Sibis. And I said, he's always there in Sibis, and he comes in the afternoon. So he said, I have a feeling that I know who he is. We had a meeting with the governor, Sujeeva Grant, at Government House one day, and he said, look, I want you to come along. Now, what I shall do after this meeting, you stay in the staff car. I'll bring this chap out, and you can have a look at him. And he did. He came out in the sunshine, walked out with Nash. And I said, well, that's the guy that I saw. And he said, oh, that's Philip Nash, the governor's secretary. So I said to him, well, what do you think is happening? Well, he said, I don't know whether you know or not. An attempt was made on Musol's life. I said, yes. Now he said, who do you think could have been behind that assassination attempt? I said, no. One can only think of Aung San and his many men. Because he was a bit of a thorn in Aung San's side. He was on the governor's council and one of the ministers. Aung San was the deputy chairman. The governor, Sujeeva Grant, was the chairman. And he was always opposing whatever everything that Aung San did. He felt that the AFPFL were in the majority of that council and they were dictating terms and what have you. He said that he was the only experienced man because he'd been the prime minister pre-war. And he knew about government and he knew about politics and what have you. And then, of course, the next thing was I was up in Tonga at the time, that there was an attempt made on his life and he lost the sight of one eye. So we had no idea. We had no idea except that this Ben Gunn's missing from the, and Sten Gunn's missing from the police depot. The next thing that Tom Lowe said he heard was about a million rounds of 303 and Sten ammunition had gone missing from the ammunition depot on the 7th mile, which Jack Moore was the OC. He was one of the army officers used to visit Usaw, by the description given. So we go on, and eventually turn around and says, look, I said, I'm finding it a bit awkward, because he said, look, I don't want you to go into Rangoon, I don't want you to meet anybody. And I said, look, this is getting a bit forced. I was nipping back to Tonga every now and again to go see my wife and children, and coming back again, he said, okay, look, we better put this on a much more regular basis. I'm transferring you to the CID in Rangoon as an additional deputy assistant to the DIG CID. So I come into the secretary in Rangoon. My wife and children are then moved to quarters in NCD for the particular post. And on the 19th of July, I'm sitting in my office in the secretariat on the ground floor, not far away from the Inspector General of Police's offices, the Deputy Inspector General of Police's offices, and must have been about 11 o'clock. I know it was drizzling. I didn't notice it was drizzling, but anyway, I was inside. And I had an Indian inspector, we were looking at a particular case. It was a case to do with some fraud investigation that was going on. And he was showing me this.